Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Olu Orange on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Travis White. I'd like to, of course, reserve whatever time I have for rebuttal. May it please the Court. The question that every other question in this case is subsumed by is, were the defendants permitted to engage in a weapons frisk of Travis White because of what he said? This is a First Amendment case. Travis White engaged in constitutionally protected criticism of the police, and an attempted weapons frisk because of his criticism devolved into him being tasered and arrested. His First Amendment claim was dismissed on summary judgment, and at trial the jury found against him on his Fourth Amendment claims in the absence of consideration of his First Amendment claim, that his speech was protected and not the proper basis for a weapons frisk. When asked at trial...
Well, counsel, let me just stop you because I'm not sure I'm with you even to this point.
Sure.
Let's say that the only thing that had happened to Mr. White was that they had told him, get out of the car, we're going to do a pat-down. Okay? And that's all that happened. None of the other stuff that followed occurred, right? The tackle, the tasering, the arrest. Are you saying that your client would have a valid First Amendment claim just on the basis of, hey, the police asked him to get out of the car and did a pat-down and that was at the end of it?
Yes. Under Ramirez, yes. And what Ramirez tells us, this court's opinion in Ramirez, is that you cannot base a weapons frisk on a cursory opinion that or a conclusory opinion that the defendant was testy or that the defendant gave you concerns about officer safety. There has to be actually some basis to believe that he was armed and dangerous.
Well, but I guess I'm just trying to focus on from a First Amendment standpoint.
Yes.
As I understand it, the interest you have as the plaintiff here is I don't want the officer to do something that's going to chill my right to engage in First Amendment speech. But I guess I would have thought that the officer has to do a lot more than just ask you to get out of the car and do a pat-down in order to basically shut you up.
Well, the way I understood the question was that the officer actually did the pat-down.
Right.
Okay? And if the officer engages in a frisk of you, if he violates your personal integrity under the Fourth Amendment to be free from actual invasion in that regard because of something that you said, then yes.
But that, I guess that's what I'm having a problem with. Doesn't the officer have to do something significant enough action against you to silence you? Because I wouldn't be silenced just by officer patting me down. I'd probably keep cussing him out, right?
Well,
if I get tackled and tasered and arrested, I'll probably shut up at that point. But I'm just saying, to me, if all that happened was the pat-down, I don't see how would you have a valid First Amendment claim if that's all that occurred?
Well, in this situation, that's not all that occurred. And so if you look at Hopkins versus Bonvicino, an opinion penned by Judge Reinhart, what it tells us is that you analyze a Fourth Amendment seizure in different stages. And the first stage here was that Mr. White was pulled out of the car. The next stage is that when they took him to the back of the car and they attempted to frisk him, that's when he turned around and asked what was going on, and they tasered him and beat him up. Okay. Now, each one of those levels of detention has to be analyzed separately.
That's exactly my problem with your First Amendment claim, because I'm saying if all that had happened was the pat-down, to me that just doesn't sound like enough to silence someone. What prompted the escalation, in my view, of your client's encounter with the police was when he spun around when they were trying to handcuff him. And at that point, it seems to me no reasonable jury could infer that the officer was motivated to, I guess, bear hug him and take him down and taser him based on what he was saying, as opposed to the fear that, hey, the guy's about to attack me. He just spun around when I was trying to arrest, when I was trying to handcuff him.
Well, that's a concern that was addressed specifically by a case, Skoog versus County of Clackamas. It's a Ninth Circuit opinion from 2006. And what Skoog addressed was the notion of having to exclude other reasons for probable cause existing, aside from the intent to, or pleading the intent to, improving the intent to silence someone. And what Skoog really explained was that you don't have to. To the extent that there is the potential basis for a jury to conclude that the objective was to silence the person, then the existence of other probable cause factors doesn't keep you from being able to set forth a claim for the violation of the First Amendment.
Counsel, I wanted to go back to the question about whether a pat-down search would be sufficient under our case law. And Skoog requires an objective test, whether a person of ordinary firmness would be chilled by whatever the activity is. And are there any cases from this circuit or that you're aware of from the Supreme Court? I'm not, so that's why I'm asking the question, that hold one way or the other on whether a pat-down is an action that would chill or silence a person of ordinary firmness from exercising their First Amendment rights.
I'm not aware of any. The only two cases that I can point the court in the direction of would be Ramirez, which I think incorporates Terry when it says that the Fourth Amendment tolerates no frisk in the absence of a belief that the person is armed and dangerous, and I understand that that refers to the Fourth Amendment as opposed to the First Amendment. However, I think the issue here is that these officers have to have been in the lawful performance of their duties.
Well, that's a different question. What I was trying to get at was whether Judge Watford is a person of ordinary firmness. I mean, I would be chilled by having police take me out of the car, and maybe I'm extraordinarily not firm in my ability to speak, but we have to find that objective standard somehow. At least I take Skoog to be saying that there's an objective standard. The ordinary person, would their First Amendment opportunity be chilled by this action?
Well, I would argue that if the pat-down is indeed a violation of their Fourth Amendment rights, then it's not unreasonable to believe that the violation of the Fourth Amendment rights would also chill First Amendment expression.
Well, the problem, it seems to me, in this case is that the Fourth Amendment case was tried and you lost, and so I guess I'm having difficulty seeing how that is helpful to you.
It's helpful to me because the Fourth Amendment case was tried in the absence of the First Amendment claim. And if the jury had been told that what Mr. White said and how he said it was protected and it was also a basis for him to recover and it wasn't a basis for him to be seized or searched, then I think that there would have been more of a balance there, and the jury would have been able to consider the facts in all of the law that related to the factual situation. But to have a Fourth Amendment case where someone is snatched from the car, searched, and tasered at the back of the car because of what they said, and the officers admit that they did this because of what they said. If I could quote for a minute, if there's any question about that, exactly what the officer said. This is in the reporter's transcript, 703, page 703, lines 1 through 14. All right, you said you were going to investigate. Pat him down. Why were you going to pat him down? Given his behavior, it's in my experience, people who speak to us in a manner like that, it's not uncommon that with their verbal interaction with us can often sometimes dictate their physical action with us. So it would be an officer safety issue for me to pat him down before we continue talking to him and investigating ultimately. This is the First Amendment issue is why they took him to the back of the car. They weren't in the lawful performance of his duties trying to do a weapons frisk because of what he said.
So if we adopted that rule that you've just articulated, wouldn't that mean that an officer could basically never make any investigatory decision based on something that a suspect that they're investigating has said?
No. What it would mean is that the content of what the suspect said would have to indicate that there was reason to believe that the person may be armed and dangerous.
So there's a difference between I hate the police and you're ugly versus you guys better watch out.
Precisely.
Okay.
And there was nothing that Mr. White said that indicated that he may be armed and dangerous. And what the officers did, as indicated by their own testimony, is they took him back there to try to do a weapons frisk on him, which requires that you be armed and dangerous, because of what he said. You just can't do that.
How did the pat-down come into the case? The only thing I saw was with respect to a request for jury instructions, and even the jury instructions that were requested didn't have the words reasonable suspicion, armed and dangerous in them. So how was this presented to the district court?
It was presented to the district court at and the page numbers, transcript 826 through 831. I requested from the district court, and this is also at appellant's excerpt of record 30, the Ninth Circuit model instruction 9.11 that included a search of the person portion, where what I asked for was the district court to inform the jury that the search of the person had to be reasonable. And when I asked for that, I explained that they searched them for weapons without any notion that or any information that would properly be the basis to believe that he was armed and dangerous. That was specifically what was argued to the court, and that was the instruction that was requested.
And what was the district court's rationale for rejecting that instruction?
District court's rationale for rejecting the instruction was that the officer may not have actually started and performed a frisk. And she said that Mr. White had testified that he didn't feel the officer's hands on him. I had argued that the officer began the search, but her conclusion was that if there was no search, there's no need for a search instruction. My position is, well, they need to know that the officer has to be in the lawful performance of his duties, and if he's not in the lawful performance of his duties when he's attempting to search him, then Mr. White turning around and asking why he's being searched shouldn't be the basis for any finding against him on the Fourth Amendment claim.
As I read your complaint, though, you did not have a standalone Fourth Amendment claim based on an unreasonable search, did you?
No, but I did say that he was searched unreasonably. And in the heading, which I know the heading doesn't actually convey or mean too much, it said unreasonable search and seizure, and we said that he was searched without lawful basis.
I think it's count two, the First Amendment complaint. First Amendment complaint, that's what I remember looking at. It just, the Fourth Amendment claim was based entirely on an unreasonable seizure. My question for you is, Why were you entitled to that instruction on an unreasonable search if you didn't have a standalone claim?
Well, we don't need a standalone claim. We actually, so long as the facts in the complaint support the cause of action, then the cause of action exists. And we actually did say that he was searched without lawful basis.
Yeah,
in the
paragraph 42 on AER 44 does say it's seizure, use of excessive force, and in caps, search, were without reasonable suspicion, probable cause, etc.
That was,
it does list the search as well as the seizure.
And the defendants didn't move to for summary judgment on that. That issue was still alive at trial. There was evidence that came into the record that, or didn't come into the record, that we felt would have lent itself to the notion that Mr. White was searched or attempted to be searched when the officers weren't in the lawful performance of their duties. So that means when he turned around to ask what was going on, he was really doing no wrong.
Counsel, so you have about a minute and a quarter if you want to save some of it for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will save it.
Thank you. We'll hear now from the county.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honor. It's Trevor Grimm on behalf of the County of San Bernardino and Donald Rusk and Mark Addy. it's our position that from the outset of this contact, which turned into a detention, that Mr. White was acting in a manner hostile toward the police officers, which raised their safety concerns from the very beginning.
Counsel, let me ask you specifically. It seems to me that the officers justified the frisk by what was said to them and not by any threatening action. At least that's how I read it. Is that your reading, or was there some action on his part that I missed?
Well, action being...
Action like trying to reach for something in his pocket or taking a swing at an officer, something of that nature. Or was it just what he said?
Given the totality of the circumstances, I think that you can get an officer safety issue from any factor.
That's not what I asked. Was there anything specific that was done other than things that were said that was specifically relied upon?
Well,
it's a yes or no question.
Yes.
What were the actions, apart from what was said, that were specifically relied upon?
There were plates that were covered that the officer looked to in the context, especially which we had here, where there was some information that the officers had about recent door knock burglaries. Cars are used with covered plates, and in this case there was paper plates covering an official plate.
How does the paper plate play into the question of dangerous weapons?
Well, I'll get there. I was going to say that people that are committing crimes oftentimes, and this came out of trial, will use paper plates to cover up their legitimate plates in order to hide their identity because of the fact that they're committing crimes, and they know that if their plates are not covered, that police officers will be able to run them and catch them. But also the fact that Mr. White was at the time wearing gloves also contributed to the officer safety state of mind.
People are more dangerous wearing gloves?
Well, I'm not suggesting that any one factor of standing alone would be sufficient. However, Aaron did ask what other things were done.
I asked about his actions, but...
Well, presumably Mr. White did cover his own plates, and presumably he did put on his gloves by himself.
So is the information that the police had, in the absence, if he hadn't said anything that suggested that he was angry, they're seeing that the signs of an accident on the car, the covered plates, his looking like or being dressed like the burglar that they suspected, if there had been only that, would they have had sufficient to frisk him? Would that have been sufficient to objectively raise the level of armed and dangerous? Without any speech?
I think it's a close call. I'm not sure.
Well, what if they'd said something nice like, "It's a beautiful day. Can I help you?" Would they? I mean, that's kind of even going further than Judge Akuta's example. Whether the things other than angry speech, "I hate you guys. I've always hated you guys," with expletives added, is that really the tipping point here?
You're saying had Mr. White said something like, "What a wonderful day it is"?
Yeah. Would they have thought he was armed and dangerous because it's suspicious that someone would be that nice to the police?
I can't go that far. I think it would have been a different stop under those circumstances. In fact, I think under those circumstances, he probably wouldn't have, well, possibly not even had to get out of the car. If he could have produced the identification that they asked him for. But because, and here's one other thing, and this isn't exactly the speech I don't think that you were referring to, when you said something other than speech, because I'm not talking about him cursing at them. But at the outset, they asked, "Hey, look, it looks like there's been an accident here. We'd like to get your information. Can I have your driver's license, insurance, and registration?" And then the response was not only with speech, according to our officers, that he said, "Why are you guys always fucking with me?" It was, "No, no action. I'm not going to give you what you want."
Well, suppose that had been the exchange. "We want this information." And he had politely said, "No, thank you. I don't care to do that." Would they have had a reason to fear for their safety and to frisk him? Or do we roll back into the angry comments?
Well, I think that the non-compliance, what it triggers in the officer's mind, and obviously the speech played into it also, is that he's being evasive. And that combined, if we're taking the totality, which is the covered up plates, which, you know, the whole thing is leading our officers at the scene to believe, "Look, we've got a right to ask you some questions. You're not complying with a simple request we ask for every other motorist."
Right. And so far, none of that speaks to whether they have a right to frisk his body. If somebody says to you, I want to see this information, or please tell me your name, and you say politely, no, I don't care to do that, does that give officers a reasonable fear for their safety so that they can frisk you?
That standing alone, no. But I would like to point out, though, that there's a discrepancy, and we pointed it out in our briefs, that Mr. White's claim is that he basically said on one occasion after he had been asked to get out of the car, he said, I hate the effing police.
I was wondering about this. I mean, the district court seemed to think it was important that you only take the facts that were alleged by the non-moving party here, Mr. White, and didn't consider what the police had testified to. Is there any case supporting that, or is there any case going the other way? I mean, it was very odd here because the plaintiff here disavowed cursing at the police, and it was the police who testified that they heard him cursing.
Right.
How does that affect our review of the district court's summary judgment determination?
Well, I think that the way that the case was briefed and argued, I mean, if she's going to take all reasonable inferences toward the non-moving party on that particular issue, and they were the non-moving party, I believe that she believed that his version was more favorable to him, and so...
Well, what if that's wrong? What if the police version is actually more favorable to the plaintiff? Don't we have to take all the facts that were in the record at the time of the summary judgment, because whether advertently or inadvertently, if the moving party supports the non-moving party's case, don't we have to look at all of it?
Well,
is there any case that says that? Because I was looking for one. Where that was similar to this, where the moving party's facts were more helpful to the non-moving party on one claim. Did you find any case in that vein?
No. What comes to mind is something that probably is not, would be cool fuel, where the judge can look at the whole record at the moment. But this is a different issue, I think. That's at the district court level, where the judge can sua sponte grant summary judgment in favor of the non-moving party.
Let me ask you another question that harkens back to something that was in discussion with Judge Watford earlier, and that is, what do we do with the objective test? Let's assume, which you do not concede, I understand that the police frisked Mr. White on account of what he said. And I know that's not your position. But is a frisk an action that would chill an ordinary person, or a person of ordinary firmness, however that was stated, from pursuing their speech?
Well, I would tend to agree with Judge Watford that if it was him on the spot, that, and he is a person of ordinary feelings in that kind of situation, that he would go right ahead and keep talking.
How do we know what a person of ordinary firmness would do? I couldn't find any cases that's specifically on this. Have you found any?
No, we haven't.
What's your best case on this point?
Well, unfortunately, it's not coming to mind at the moment, but I'm sure I could dig it up in my brief. It would be in our reply brief, or an answering brief. I think that the points that we were relying on are that the arguments plaintiffs made in favor of a First Amendment violation, which is the closeness, the proximity in time between the speech and the action, and the amount of speech, and the discrepancy between what Mr. White says he said, which was one isolated account just upon being removed from the car, and then you still have to travel to the back of the car. There's still the interaction between Deputy Addy and Mr. White before the actual hands-on, and that was after the deputy gave him an opportunity to just put his hands on the car, and he refused to do so. I'm not sure I'm answering your question as well as you'd like.
I think you are, because the First Amendment claim really turns on stuff that happens before he gets to the back of the car. It's the decision to make him get out and do the frisk is what prompts everything
right
to happen afterwards. So I really am interested in your best case on this, because I think a reasonable jury certainly could infer that it was his speech that caused the officers to want him to get out of the car and do the pat down.
Well,
what I'm not sure about is whether that's enough to, you know, to cause somebody to stop speaking.
Well, and what I can say is that it's not reasonable to us for someone to believe that it was his speech that made that caused the officers to get him out of the car. The officer had a complete right to get him out of the car upon his being unable to produce a valid driver's license. And we do not believe that the case is cited for the propositions that this was not driving on a highway. We don't think those apply.
Look, you got summary judgment on this. A jury could go either way. You might well be right that you could persuade a jury that the officers did not make him get out of the car just because of his speech. But it seems to me it's close enough that you would let that go to the jury if you thought that doing the pat-down was enough to chill someone's exercise of their First Amendment rights. And I guess I don't feel like you're helping us very much with the most analogous case you can point us to on that.
Well, all I can do pretty much without the ideal case at the tip of my tongue would be to try to argue the facts under what's been briefed. And there were so many alternative reasons to ask for this pat-down search, and there is the discrepancy once again between what Mr. White and what the officers say was actually said by Mr. White.
But remember, this was booted out on summary judgment, so at this point, if there's a factual dispute, which obviously there is, the only question really for us is whether there was a sufficient factual dispute of material facts, a genuine issue, to make it improper to have granted summary judgment. We don't decide who is more persuasive if there's evidence going both ways, and I think that may be where these questions are coming from.
Well, at the summary judgment phase, the facts I guess were in dispute. They just weren't presented in a manner in which they were in dispute, because they presented from their position, hey, this is all we did. This is best for us. This is all we did. We said, you know, I hate the FM police. That's all I said on one occasion after I'd been removed from the car. That's it. And so
but the police said otherwise. The police said otherwise, and so that takes us back to the legal question that Judge Ikuda was asking you about, which is, does the district court have to look at the entire summary judgment record that is presented? Because what's good for your Fourth Amendment claim may be bad for your First Amendment claim, and I think that's maybe what happened here, is that both of you were arguing your best Fourth Amendment claim, which turned out to be exactly the opposite of what was helpful to you in your First Amendment claim. And rather than let them both go to the jury as alternative ways to look at the facts, the court simply took away one of them. And I think that's maybe where the issue lies here.
Did defendant argue, I mean, did the plaintiff argue in the alternative?
I do not believe that, no.
So the plaintiff never said, well, this is what we think happened, but in the alternative, if the police are right and he was cursing throughout the whole thing, then we want the benefit of that.
No, I do not believe that happened. And again, you know, I don't have the case, but our position is that if that's the way the case was briefed, regardless of how it was briefed, we had sufficient alternative speech-neutral reasons for, and, you know, getting him out of the car, walking him back to the back of the car, asking him to spread his legs voluntarily to conduct a quick pat-down. We had reasons totally independent of speech, and, you know, while it did contribute to it, it wasn't the determining factor. It was just the totality of the circumstances.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired, and I think we understand your position.
Thank you.
Mr. Orange, you have about a minute remaining.
Your Honor, just to really quickly answer a few questions and address a couple of points. Mr. White did not only at one point say, I hate the effing police. Actually, he said it on multiple occasions as well as many other things. and these were all part of the record on summary judgment. I'll tell you exactly where they were.
But did your client argue that? I understood that your client argued. I only said it this one time.
No.
And disavowed the other statements.
No, that's not what happened. In his deposition, at one point he said, this is all I said, and then at another point he said, I also said this, and at another point he said, I also said this. Those are at, they're most easily found in the opposing side, supplemental excerpts of record, pages 82 and 83. They're in the four-page exhibits. Page 204, lines 10 through 15, question. At what point did you say, what is it, I hate the effing police or something like that? Answer, when he was pulling me, grabbing me out of the car. 205, lines 12 through 18. Okay, he brought you to the back of the car and you said, that's the point when you said, what? Answer, I can't stand the effing police. 209, lines 3 through 8. He also said, why are you doing this? I don't deserve this. I'm just on my lunch break. I am not a criminal. All those things were presented in the record on summary judgment. As to whether or not the district court should have considered the moving parties' facts as well as the non-moving parties' facts on summary judgment, the answer is yes. All facts have to be considered, and all reasonable inferences have to be drawn in favor.
Is there a case, did you find a case analogous to this one where the moving parties' facts were more favorable than the non-moving parties' fact? I couldn't find one.
No. The closest I found was Scott versus Harris, which is a Supreme Court case, but it doesn't involve facts versus facts. It involves testimony versus video. And in Scott versus Harris, what the court said is where there's a video that just clearly contradicts a version of the facts, then you go with the video, which is actually kind of important here because their version of the facts is that he was boisterous and crazy and all these other things while he was walking from the side of the car to the back of the car, but the video clearly shows that he just walked from the side of the car to the back of the car. So the only thing remaining during that period of time was what he said.
Counsel, you have exceeded your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. The case just argued is submitted, and we very much appreciate the arguments by both counsel. It was very helpful.